Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Bernoulli. Today, we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always my pleasure.
Great. I thought we'd do a discussion focus on one of your recent writings. It's entitled, What's Yours is Now Mine, America's Era of Accelerating Expropriation. Your initial thoughts?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that you picked this topic to discuss this month, Richard, because it's a topic that's near and dear to my thinking. And I think that you and I have discussed many elements of it, but never quite under this topic. And so what I'm referring to here about accelerating expropriation is the expropriation of labor's value. In other words, value that created by labor is what's being expropriated, as opposed to the traditional sense of expropriation, which is of capital, where a revolutionary government comes in and basically takes over ownership of the factories, mines, banks, and so on from capital. But I think what we're seeing now is an acceleration of the expropriation of labor. And I've listed a few elements which I consider expropriation. One is proliferating junk fees and permits, license renewals. You know, this is for the average person, right? The average laborer, where a permit, a renewal, a license or whatever used to be like maybe $10 or $15 or $20. Well, now it's routinely $50 or, you know, a fishing license, you know, $100, a boating license, you know, $500, license to renew your business, $1,000, you know, all these junk fees have been skyrocketing. And of course they come out of normal people's pay. These are not fees associated with capital. They're fees associated with citizenship or just being a regular laborer, you know, a worker.
Yeah. And they add
another,
right? Like each one of those might not be too much individually, but taken all together, they add up quite significantly.
Yes. Especially if you're in small business, because, you know, there's these are especially extremely expensive for, like, say, late fees on your business license tax. I mean, I lived in a city in California where the late fee on your business license tax was 100%.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that kind of thing, right? I mean, this isn't trying to nail Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. I mean, this is just regular small business people trying to survive. Another one is just the incredible expense in these dysfunctional sectors such as health insurance, liability insurance, disability insurance, workers' compensation. All of those industries are larded with fraud, overregulation, very little competition. And so who pays this, of course, is mostly small business. Corporations have scale and they can move their workforce overseas, et cetera. But the small business person just sees these increases of like 10, 12, 15% a year, year after year after year after year. So that's a form of expropriation. Nobody talks about it in that term, but it really is, right? And then there's taxes. And I mentioned the self-employed person in a high tax state. Now this is in the U.S., and the U.S. is supposedly a low tax nation, but that's really not true. Now, we know that in Scandinavia, people pay routinely 65% tax rates, right, if you're a high earner. But in Scandinavian countries, you receive, you know, virtually free health care for you and your family. Your higher education costs are extremely nominal. Retirement is generous and so on. Whereas here in the US, you get no health care unless you buy it yourself, right? And you have no help on higher education is just ridiculously horribly overpriced thanks to that cartel. And, you know, your public pension is modest, to say the least, Social Security. So here we go. If you start making some serious money as a worker on your labor, well, then you quickly reach 32% on the federal tax rate. Then your state, like New Jersey, California, Connecticut, New York, it's 10%. And then you get Medicare tax 3.9%. Very quickly, you're above 50%. And so how can this not be considered a very high tax rate? And yet we're not really getting very much for that. And then I also mentioned inflation, which is stealth expropriation. And as many people have noted, rampant inflation in essentials, such as food, rent, childcare, et cetera, that affects the worker, the laboring class, far more than it does those earning money off capital, because wages have been stagnant for roughly 50 years for all but the top 5%. So the people who can least afford inflation are the bottom, say, 60%. And so that's a form of expropriation that hurts labor, not capital.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's a biggie on inflation, especially now in this post-COVID era, where there's significant supply chain disruptions in all types of goods, all over on a global basis, as well as intertwined with, tariffs and trade wars that are happening, not to mention rising Chinese currency strength. So if you've been observing the Chinese yuan currency, it's been steadily increasing in strength. The Chinese used to do a lot of reliance on export-based, lower type of currency motivated export business and economy. But now that model has been shifting to more of a focus on domestic consumption. So that's where you want to have a stronger currency. So that's what's happening in China. And this is resulting in all of the exports, rising in price as well. So you've got all of these factors, supply chain disruption, trade wars, currency strength now in the Asian economies, all contributing to inflation. So there's a big, massive wave of inflation happening. You can see it in the long end of the yield curve going higher now, on U.S. interest rates. And so it's just a wave of inflation coming. Your thoughts?
Right. And if we compare, say, again, we're kind of comparing labor and capital as two basic categories. If we have capital, if we own capital, we have some techniques to shift our assets to escape the worst brunt of inflation, right? We can move some of our assets into other currencies. And if we own a major enterprise that has market share, then we can just raise our prices, right? I mean, that's what global corporations are doing, right? They're raising prices or practicing shrinkflation. And they can get away with that, where the laborer can't really say, well, look at, hey, boss, I need another $5 an hour because of inflation. I mean, there's just no bargaining power there. Right. In most positions. So labor is at a disadvantage, is what my point is here, in terms of escaping currency devaluation and inflation. And so, you and I have talked many times about social capital and other forms of wealth, if you will, other than the kind of wealth measured in financial terms. And so my takeaway from this whole idea of that labor's excess value basically is being expropriated to the point where it's really not worth working, then you might as well invest your time, money, and energy in things that are not so easily expropriated. And I need to mention real quickly what I mean by excess value of labor is let's say that you and I are working for somebody and we're making like the average wage around $50,000 a year. And we decide, well, look, we've got a great idea and we have experience in a particular sector. And we start a business and we're each making $250,000, right? Well, if we're paying $100,000 extra in tax, you know, then it's kind of like we're working like crazy and we're creating all this extra value from our labor and experience and social capital and so on. But we're not getting to keep very much of it. And so what's the point? And at some point you go, well, gee, this is a reality in at least in the U.S. that a lot of high earners, say, for instance, physicians, where they're going, you know, it's just not worth me working longer hours to make more money because I'm basically just paying all of that in taxes.
Yeah.
So what's the point?
Nail on the money there in terms of the keeping aspects, because there's so many other aspects of expropriation as well. You know, there's also the concept of wealth taxes, which are coming more and more, right, in different jurisdictions, not only in the U.S., but globally, and also higher property taxes, right, on your real property, real estate property as well. And even on your savings, right, what you're keeping in terms of savings, like a 401k plan in the U.S. or an RSP plan in Canada, very likely, in my opinion, to have the government will likely have those rules on those savings plans change to force high purchasing or high investment in the area of government debt, right, for being able to finance the unsustainable excessive government debt. And so this, you know, maybe they do a rule like must have 50% of your assets in those funds in government debt, whether it's state, provincial, or federal debt, that type of thing. So, you know, essentially that would represent ownership and a declining asset in terms of capital, yield distribution and purchasing power, right? Because, you know, all of those areas would represent a declining asset. But yeah, so especially on even, so whether you're making lots of revenue, but then it's the whole expropriation on the keeping aspect.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point, Richard, about the wealth tax and the likelihood that whatever savings or pension savings you have set aside, some of it will be expropriated, and it will be done, of course, for your own good, right? Because to keep you from buying risky cryptocurrencies or something, it's now mandated that you will own a government bond paying a 0.1%, which of course helps too. And I think you're absolutely right about the wealth tax. And here in Hawaii, there's already a special surcharge, property tax surcharge for second homes above $2 million in valuation, right? In other words, and we understand, okay, that means you have a second home worth $2 million or more. Well, you are obviously pretty well off. And it's not a very high fee, but it's we know how those things go. Pretty soon it's down to $1 million. Pretty soon it's every second home. Pretty soon it's any property worth $1 million and so on, right? So the creeping wealth tax as you describe it, is absolutely real already. And we can anticipate it accelerating. So what other forms of wealth can we invest in that is much more difficult for the government to expropriate? And so let's talk a little bit about that. We've talked about social capital, small business, small enterprises, networks where you're bartering value. And I think that's a big element in traditional cultures and traditional economies, right? Still, and to this day. So for instance, I just saw an example where someone, you know, raises cattle on their land and then they exchange the cattle with a neighbor who slaughters it for themselves. And in terms of running a slaughterhouse, that's enormously expensive, hugely regulated. It's just impossible. But if you're allowed to slaughter your own farm animal for your own consumption, and then, you know, you can trade that meat with your neighbor who raised the cow, that kind of thing, that's an example of economic activity that isn't transacted in currency. And so therefore it's much harder to tax or expropriate. And just the fact that you're investing in social networks where you're helping people, you have a network of associates, then it's a form of capital that's very resilient, because you're building social bonds and trust, and that will get you through hard times, so to speak. You'll help each other out, and that takes a large investment of time and energy. But it's a form of wealth that you can draw upon and count on and trust that can't be expropriated. And then you and I have talked about ESG and sustainable development. And I think that this is a very important topic here, because governments around the world are making a lot of investment in trying to support these sustainable development ideas in their own economies, right? And so the idea that the government would expropriate people who are trying to invest in the things they're promoting, that would be a very hard political sell, you know, for the government, as opposed to just it's easy to take abstract wealth, right? Wealth in a third home or something like that. No one's going to resist that. But if you're going to take assets that were specifically invested to promote what the government says it wants, obviously that's going to have political blowback and be a difficult for the government to do. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how that topic of ESG and sustainable development could be a more resilient form of wealth.
Yeah, and even here in Canada, now the government has just recently announced that if you have established a business which can help to reduce, for example, carbon emissions, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, that if you're in that business, then they will reduce your taxes by 50%, essentially. So that's quite an incentive, you know, for those type of businesses. But yeah, there's all kinds of initiatives now happening globally. You've got the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. There's 17 of those, and those translate into 169 target initiatives for sustainable development. And this can apply to businesses that are promoting these type of goals, you know, in their businesses, whether it be from their business model or what type of impact investments they do. We actually have an asset allocation model that we look at to evaluate businesses on such merit, you know, for helping society and the environment and how well they promote the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So this is all synergistic as well to equity performance that we have found. So it's a good story overall, and it goes together with a lot of the writings that you've done in your blog posts and in your books, as far as like market environmentalism, with a focus on localized, decentralized businesses, as you mentioned. If you wanted to talk a little bit more about that, like how a focus on localized or decentralized economy and businesses can help in that regard.
Yeah, I think like what we're kind of outlining here, I think, is as the conventional view is go try to make as much money as you can for your labor, and then invest in the traditional, you know, mix of stocks and bonds, you know, it's these sort of abstract financial instruments. And those are both avenues for your labor, excess value you create with your labor being expropriated, and your wealth invested in these abstract financial instruments will also be easily expropriated either by wealth taxes, surcharges, and just really high taxes on your labor. Where what we're suggesting is if you went to work for, you know, localized, decentralized, small businesses and small enterprises that are linked together to provide, like, say, food security or alternative energy, the things that the government is trying to incentivize, you're not going to make a ton of money, but you're going to get to keep most of it, and you're going to have satisfaction because you'll have much more control over your life. And whatever assets you do accumulate, you can invest in those exact same businesses. And so, you know, your capital is at work and your labor is at work in these sectors that you can feel good about and you can actually have agency and control in. And so that I think is a two-pronged sort of strategy we're suggesting to keep more of what you earn and have an avenue of investing in something real as opposed to some abstraction that's controlled by Wall Street. You know, that's like, do you really want to do that with your money? How about do something useful? And you've said that in your, you know, that your investment portfolio in these types of businesses has returned like between 20 and 40% a year, which is, and doing something useful. That to me is really impressive.
Yeah, exactly. It's not only about... you know, making money, but also helping society and the environment at the same time. We found that to be very synergistic, and especially in a way that is using the principles of the Austrian school of economics, market environmentalism, promoting the UN sustainable development goals. So, yeah, we take an approach based on that and found that to be quite successful. It's overall it's the new investment paradigm as we see it. So, you know, not only looking at the shareholders, but also customers, employees, communities, the so-called approach that is based on stakeholder capitalism is very synergistic for all stakeholders. And provides also meaningful work and meaningful businesses that we look at.
Yeah, and in terms of policies that could be instigated that would correct some of this expropriation of labor that we discussed, you mentioned what I consider just a very straightforward but extremely valuable idea. Is just that there should be no tax whatsoever on the first, say, $50,000 of earnings, you know, and that to compensate for whatever relatively modest amount of taxes that were taken off of that, you know, median income, then maybe we could put a tax in on the consumption of natural resources that are not renewable. And so, in other words, corporations that are engaged in extracting non-renewable resources would pay a tax on that. And that would, of course, be passed on to the consumer as a real cost in all the goods and services that are result from that. And then, but more importantly, the creation of value by labor for at least the first 50,000 or so would be free. And so that would incentivize people to want to work, want to do something useful and make capital. And then it would also allocate the taxes fairly, because frankly, you know, the earth is not infinite. And so if we're going to tax anything, we should tax the non-renewable resources which are being consumed. That's, to me, a much better idea than a carbon tax. Which just creates another market to be gamed by Wall Street, in my view.
Yeah, exactly. And based on your writings, blog posts, and books, as a final question here in our discussion today, could you give some examples of either industries or businesses or jobs that would make sense, you know, in this approach, as you see it, and in terms of the new economy?
Right. Well, I think a lot of people are, because of these supply chain disruptions globally, I think there's obviously just a national security and national resilience issue in reshoring the critical supply chains. And so I think there's a high tech, low tech and service element in reshoring, because, you know, like, say, just to take semiconductors, the U.S. is only supplying like 12% of its own semiconductors now. And so you could say, well, clearly there's a role there for boosting semiconductor production, which would mean building fabrication factories and hiring workers and all of that supply chain. So there's I think, room there. But then in food security, say, there's clearly room in like the localized farming sector. And we've talked about this, you know, the farm to table movement, organic farming, and using some technology in terms of like drone surveillance or even automatic weeding machines. I mean, there's a certain tech element there to providing food security and without using monoculture, you know, heavy use of pesticides, stripping the soil, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of manual labor and that's needed and useful and that element. And in terms of services, you know, like I was just harping on the just how dysfunctional and overly expensive like healthcare is in the U.S. So there's obviously a huge amount of growth in localizing healthcare that's aimed at actually improving people's health from the ground up, as opposed to treating the symptoms of diseases that they've developed from, you know, unhealthy lifestyles. So, and of course, there's always alt energy, right? We're used to thinking of alt energy as these huge companies, but really a lot of alt energy is the local electrical grid and, you know, solar panels and installing battery units and for electric cars. And there's a lot of localized development in alt energy as well, especially in terms of boosting the efficiency of consumption. So those are some preliminary ideas.
Well, those are great examples, and it's been great insight in this discussion on this trend of expropriation that is just accelerating, as you mentioned in your writing. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com and download free sample chapters of my books.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
All right. End it there.
Well, I think we did okay.
Yeah, that was great.
Well, thank goodness you know, I could just kind of read my own blog post.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No,
I really.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
No, I just, I think it was great that we could tie it into ESG. You know, I think that's a really powerful element of this is, hey, look at, exactly. I mean, I never really thought about it before, but if the government's promoting this stuff and giving tax breaks and stuff, that really makes it more, yeah, resilient as an investment.
Yes, exactly. And the whole, you know, carbon offsets or carbon credits business, we're actually looking to get into that as well. So we're looking at formulating a partnering arrangement with this organization called Moss Earth. It's based in Brazil, and they actually are have their carbon credits based on blockchain technology, which is really cool because, you know, it introduces the concept of accountability, right, at all levels and aspects of the business. And what they do is they have an arrangement where they have five businesses set up, not that they own, but they have a relationship with five businesses in Brazil that essentially enhance the communities, or they do like forest forest research and enhancement of sustainability, right, in the Amazon rainforest, all that. So what happens is as they enhance the sustainability of the Amazon rainforest, that actually creates these carbon credits. And this is all verifiable by third-party independent verification type of organizations. So they verify this work and this enhancement and sustainability. And so that automatically creates these carbon credits. And so they'll essentially sell that to Moss Earth, which then puts it on this blockchain platform. And so they now have these tokens, these tokenized, like a token of one ton of carbon dioxide. Essentially, each token represents one ton of carbon dioxide. And now the businesses like a hydro company or a utility company, energy company that is burning a lot of fossil fuels, or they're burning a lot of releasing a lot of carbon greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. They can now purchase these carbon credits to offset what they're doing. You see what I'm saying? So,
right.
And then so by this process, they can then claim that they are carbon net neutral. Maybe now or they have a target phased program, so that by 2030 they'll be carbon net neutral. Meaning, not that they're not producing, but their net is essentially zero. So meaning these purchase of carbon credits or other programs they're doing essentially negates what they're doing on the other side of the equation, right? The other side of the fence. Which is being represented by enhanced sustainability in forest lands, farmlands, and croplands, especially, because there's a fact out there. If you increase the sustainability of these lands, forest lands, croplands, and farmlands, if you increase the sustainability by only 5 to 10%, you then negate all of the carbon greenhouse gas emissions, like globally, like what's being done by humankind and in industry, like globally, literally around the world. Problem solved, in other words. So that's
right.
Yeah. So it all, and this is like a market-based market environmentalism. So it's not like you're doing a carbon tax and you got to pay more money, and there's an ROI to it, and it makes sense. All stakeholders are benefiting.
Yeah, that's the thing that worries me when I've read about Wall Street's thing, is it's just, there's either a carbon tax that then is like this free floating slush fund, right?
Yeah.
And then that's of course just ripe for, abuse. And then the other thing is I can just see Wall Street banks claiming that they planted 10 million trees, but then they may have planted the 10 million trees, but nobody's there to care for them, so they die. And then yeah. It was a scam, So yeah, yeah. I'm really liking what you're telling me, yep. That this is like a sustainable thing, right. And it's trustworthy, because it's got to be verified,
Yeah.
And that takes work.
Exactly. Verifiable all along every phases, and then accountable through the blockchain format, right? Each step. It has a little bit of information added to it in a chain of, blockchain format. So, it's pretty cool. So we're looking at setting up a relationship with those guys. What the idea would be to replicate that Brazil model into Canada, and then even maybe Spain. We have some partners there. So, we could help in that regard. With like doing the consulting services, with the setting up the exchange, buying and selling carbon tokens, right? So some people might want to just buy the tokens for investment as well, so that you'll have that type of exchange features as well, right?
Yeah,
like in the commodities market, right? Some people are actually buying these things for hedging purposes, right? There's according to accounting standards, either buying or selling if they need if they're making bread, they, you know, they need to hedge on the wheat price or something, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, it's just creating a little liquidity, you know. It's always good to have a little liquidity. Yeah. Otherwise, there's nobody to sell it to.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with a lot of crypto stuff is it's really not liquid. And then, so, well, that's terrific. I'm so glad you explained that to me, Richard. You know, I, that's really where it's encouraging to me that there's somebody, that there's people trying to do this correctly, you know, where it can be verified and then they're using the blockchain. Yeah. All innovative, but and I've read the same thing that, you know, if 10% greater efficiency, if you will, and, you know, improving just the biomass management, you know, of mostly indigenous peoples, right?
Yeah.
And that would make it. Yeah, it's not the tree farms that Weyerhaeuser owns that's the issue so much. It's like what's happening in the rest of the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, and if people can make more money doing something good, they will be happy to do so. That's the whole thing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, right.
Yeah. No. So I'm really happy you're working on that. You have a lot of innovative things you're working on. I'm happy that you tell me about it because otherwise I would never hear about it.
No, it's quite exciting. I mean, you get up in the morning because you know you feel good. It's not just about making money, right? It's just helping people, helping society, helping the environment, right? It's all exciting, you know, in that regard, right? You know,
yeah,
I'm happy to do that, I think. Yeah,